This is Erica Bakiaki. She has compiled a book called The Cost of Choice, Women Evaluate the Impact of Abortion. Erica received a graduate degree in theology from BC, that's Boston College, where she was a Bradley Fellow. Now an attorney living in Boston, Massachusetts. And Erica, good morning and welcome to the show.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Absolutely. I guess the first question off my mind and off my lips is, why did you feel that you needed to assemble this book, The Cost of Choice, Women Evaluating the Impact of Abortion?
Well, there's sort of a very practical reason, and then there's my background. I guess the background may be more interesting, and that is that I actually was a very ardent pro-choice feminist in college. I went to Middlebury College up in Vermont and was one of the leaders of the Women's Center there. And when I went down to Washington, D.C. to do a semester, a junior year type thing, and started working on welfare reform as my internship, I came to discover that this right I thought was so important was actually used by, now and these pro-abortion feminists as a supposed way out of poverty for poor women. And that really began to haunt me. And I thought, this doesn't seem right that we would care for the poor in this very rich nation by saying, get rid of those unborn children. So I really started to rethink abortion, which was very difficult, of course, going back to college and telling people I was sort of ambivalent at this point about abortion. I came around for many different reasons. Of course, beginning to see the dignity of all life. I was having, at the same time, a religious conversion. It was all very exciting, actually. And then sort of intellectually came around to see how the harm that abortion had done to women. So when I graduated from law school, I was sort of familiar with Women Affirming Life, which is here in Boston, and they were putting together a series of symposia with Americans United for Life and Feminists for Life. And so they had these symposia on the 30th anniversary or around the 30th anniversary of Roe versus Wade at three different schools, Boston College Law, St. John's Law, and Georgetown University, and brought together many women and a few men, about 20 or 25 in total. And I was one of the speakers at the Boston College Law Symposium, just sort of telling my story and going through the philosophical underpinnings of this culture of choice. And we just decided that these were really remarkable and that we should pull together the best ones. And that's what we did. Lots of people were skeptical we'd find a publisher, but our pro-choice agent loved the book, thinks it's one of the most balanced books out there. Mm-hmm. And so we went ahead and we found a publisher, and that's where we are now. So the book itself contains 12 essays by all women, doctors, lawyers, scholars, some of whom are very well-known, Harvard Law's Marianne Glendon, Elizabeth Fox Genovese from Emory, Jean Beth Elstein from University of Chicago, as well as Tufts University of Michigan Medical School. It's quite a crew.
It is, and what I found so forceful about it, Erica, was that there's a real scarcity of argument against abortion. There's the basic religious tenets that a lot of people use, that you're killing life, but there aren't a lot of arguments out there about what it actually does to women.
That's right.
And you've been able to put that together.
That's right. And, Feminists for Life has really been on the forefront of this. What I sort of see is this book is the intellectual underpinnings of some of the sort of arguments or the statements that Sarah Foster has done so well with Feminists for Life. She's actually received a lot of press since John Roberts was nominated, which is great. And just talking about how sort of women shouldn't have to choose and that there's a better way. So what we look at, the doctors and lawyers, et cetera, is how instead of abortion being the symbol of freedom and equality, as these pro-abortion feminists have said, really abortion has been terribly costly for women. And on the medical side, it's really sort of the most scary, and that is that women who've had abortion suffer an increased risk of anxiety, depression, substance abuse, and suicide. In fact, the risk of death from suicide is up to 6 times higher when compared with women who have given birth.
Wow.
And then it goes on, induced abortion increases the risk of placenta previa and subsequent pregnancies by 50%. And those of you who know what that is, it significantly poses a risk to the health of both mother and child in that subsequent pregnancy, and induced abortion increases the risk of preterm birth. It's doubled, in fact, in subsequently delivered children. And what I just think is, you know, really scary about that is that approximately one doctor said that approximately 30% of preterm births, which now account for 6% of all births, are actually attributable to prior abortions. And when you have a low birth weight baby, which is what you have generally when you have a preterm birth, there's a much greater risk, in fact, a 38 times greater risk for having cerebral palsy when that baby is born between 20 and 27 weeks. So there's all sorts of a mess created here.
That's right.
And it's been documented in the medical literature, and yet we don't really hear too much about it. And, of course, there's the breast cancer link, which you've heard more about.
That's right. When we come back, we're going to talk about some of the other effects that the pro-choice movement and the effects on women right after this break. You're going to stay with us, aren't you, Erica?
Yes, absolutely.
Great.
With us this hour, author Erica Bakayaki, and she has compiled a book.
12 essays.
We'll say authored, but 12 essays. The Cost of Choice, Women Evaluate the Impact of Abortion. And Erica, welcome back.
Hi, thanks.
The thing that comes across so forcefully in your book is that pro-choice really isn't pro-woman, is it?
That's right. And, you know, a great group of women, the early American feminists who fought for the right to vote and fair treatment in the workplace, would have really been appalled at the thought of celebrating abortion as the symbol of women's freedom and equality. The suffragettes, who all of us, of course, admire, and few of us realize their stance on abortion, they were actually uniformly against abortion because they saw it as an attack on women as women, those uniquely endowed with the ability to bear children. So when you see these women out there, you know, National Organization for Women and NARAL, et cetera, talking about being so pro-woman, in fact, you know, those great pro-life feminists would have said to them, you know, by fighting for abortion instead of seeking solutions to the underlying reasons for abortion, they basically have told women, you must choose either your baby or yourself. And again, talking about right. The poor, instead of seeking real solutions to the plight of poor women, they've told women, in order to get out of poverty, you better rid yourselves of those unborn children. And then to the well-educated woman, the culture says, this is a man's world. You'd better become more like a man, that is, not pregnant, if you want to succeed. This doesn't sound very pro-woman to me.
Exactly. We have to lift up women who take a heroic step and actually have children instead of saying to them, it would be easier for you if you just had this abortion.
That's right. And, you know, ordinary women like you and me and all those women out there who are in the great majority want to be honored as women, you know, not to have to sacrifice our children for equality with men. And what I find really fascinating is that, you know, more than 30 years after the second wave, what I like to call the abortion wave of the women's movement, studies still show us that women are more perplexed about how to combine sort of a professional life and family than anything else. So abortion back then during, you know, the 60s really hijacked this pioneering feminism that sought to influence society to change in a way that recognized this distinct dignity of women. And so it really forestalled solutions to how women could fulfill their unique role as mothers. I mean, just the future of our civilization, while participating in this wider society as well. Instead, you know, Roe versus Wade and the judges there, all men, of course. And not to be bad, you know, I love my husband, I love men, of course. Sure. But it's just, you know, you see sort of the misogyny in the abortion movement because, you know, we're really saying to women, you got to become like men. We're not gonna take the time, the money, the resources, the ingenuity it would take to actually change culture so that you can participate in the wider culture while you're raising your children. Not to say, you know, every single thing has to change, but that we can be hospitable to women, as those who are the bearers of children, as the nurturers of children generally, first and foremost. Instead, we're just gonna say, oh, it's much easier for us just to make you like men.
That's right. And well, the thing is, in the book, you've divided it into three different parts. Abortion, women and culture, abortion and women's health, which you document some major studies, but also abortion, law regulation, and alternatives.
Mm-hmm.
And under the one thing that struck me was the abortion alternative legislation, where you point out that compelling story about Lisa Beamer. Do you want to elaborate on that?
Oh, sure. You know, it's just this very, very sad thing that many of, you know, your listeners may have heard that after September 11th, Planned Parenthood thought they would be so generous and tell all those women who had their unborn babies, who became fatherless because of what happened on September 11th, told them, you know, you can have free abortions if you'd like. And it's just absolutely
unbelievable.
Right, incredible. And of course, most of these women, I suspect, I mean, Lisa Beamer, et cetera, of course, went on to have their babies, and they see in their babies' eyes, you know, the great joy and the memory of their husbands. It's really incredible that they, I mean, they're not on the same planet, I think, sometimes, Planned Parenthood, although they are influencing culture a bit, but just to think that, you know, here, let me help your suffering by giving you what will end up being more suffering.
Yeah. Wow.
Unbelievable. And the fact is, too, in that section you talk about the new back alley, which is the abortion clinic clinic regulations.
That's right. And, you know, you hear, you know, the back when Roe came down, that, you know, legal abortion would make abortion safe and rare. And, in fact, that's not the case at all, because the pro-abortion side really fights every single regulation, tooth and nail. I mean, parental notification, any type of women's right to know bills. In fact, there's only 22 states that have women's right to know laws. In other words, women don't know what they're going to do. They don't know. They don't understand fetal development. They don't understand these medical consequences I've told you about. And it's an incredibly sad fate for women who then end up going in not knowing who this doctor is who's going to be, you know, aborting their child. And it ends up really in a lot of occurrences, and they're documented, though quietly in a lot of places, but in this book they're documented, really becoming like the back alley that was talked about back then.
Erica, why do you suppose a lot of the information that you've compiled in your book has not seen a clear light of day?
Well, probably because many people are scared. I mean, Angela Lanfranchi, who writes really compellingly on the breast cancer link, talks about how she has been silenced in a lot of ways by the medical community. I mean, especially the ABC link is one that has really had a hard time getting out. Mm-hmm. And, you know, that's something we could just spend a couple of minutes on if you
sure.
want, just talking about the differences there. But, you know, sort of there are two mechanisms by which abortion can increase the risk of breast cancer, and we can get to that. But let me just finish and say
okay.
that I really think that women, I mean, it's the same type of thing, not to go on to a totally different subject, but why people don't ever talk about daycare having some harms for children or anything like that. I mean, people out there are scared to say anything that might confront, you know, this sort of mainstream feminism. And yet, it's really pulling the wool over so many women's eyes because they think everyone must believe this because this is what the media talks about. This is what all those talking heads who are women talk about. So it's really a shame. And that's why The Cost of Choice, I think, is such an important book.
And you were talking about some of the effects, I mean, the health consequences. And when you first came on, you talked about the long-term consequences to our health, to future pregnancies. But breast cancer, you see that in studies overseas as well.
Yeah, that's right. And it's important for everyone to understand these two different mechanisms because I didn't understand this. And it's really key because one of these is totally beyond dispute. And the other mechanisms by which abortion can increase the risk of breast cancer is more hotly contested. And that's the one you always hear about. So let me first get to the one that's beyond dispute because it itself is really, really quite scary. And that is that when abortion acts as a delay of a woman's first full-term pregnancy, as in teens or young women who have a great majority of the abortions because they don't already have children, it increases the risk of breast cancer. Now, where you see this is that research shows that teenagers with a family history of breast cancer, so mom, grandma, great-grandma, whatever, mm-hmm. who have had abortions before their 18th birthday because they haven't likely had any babies, you know, any other pregnancies, full-term pregnancies, right. These very young women, have an incalculably high risk of developing breast cancer. There was actually a case in Portland, Oregon, that settled recently where a 19-year-old went into the clinic, said that she had a history of breast cancer on her intake form and wasn't told about this breast cancer link. And the clinic actually settled and basically said she won because this risk is so well known in the medical community. But again, it's not talked about because none of it wants to be talked about. And what the medical community often does, or, you know, especially those that are, under the powerful arm of the the pro-abortion lobby, is that they try to conflate it with this more hotly contested abortion breast cancer link. And that's where it doesn't matter whether it's your first pregnancy or later on, whatever it is, but because abortion artificially terminates a woman's pregnancy just when her breast cells have been exposed to these high levels of estrogen, which is a potentially cancer-forming agent, mm-hmm. but before her breast cells have matured into cancer-resistant cells, this abortion can also, just in a physiological way, increase the risk of breast cancer. And that's where, it's kind of confusing, but that's where you got to read Angela and Franchi's piece in The Cost of Choice to really understand these two different mechanisms and how this physiological aspect has also been documented in epidemiological studies. And it is more hotly contested, but there's also good evidence for that as well.
In the book, there are, again, the 12 essays, essentially, that you've compiled that are filled with statistics and facts, but there is also one in there by Elizabeth Schultz. The prenatal testing and genetic abortion, and that one I found extraordinarily compelling.
Yeah, that is probably, in my mind, too, the most moving of the entire book. She's a law professor who's a mother of four, and when she was pregnant with her third Petey, she learned that he would have Down syndrome. She did sort of all the tests just to, know what she'd be facing if, in fact, she had he had Down syndrome. So she did all the tests, and while she was pregnant, even while she was, big and the baby was kicking inside, she was really amazed by colleagues, by acquaintances, etc., when they found out that she was carrying a baby with Down syndrome, because they would look at her kind of aghast, like, you're going to go through with this? And then she found, even after she had the baby, and there was her Down syndrome baby, her wonderful, image of God right in front of these people, and they would be so shocked and, not necessarily verbally say, but when they found out that she knew beforehand that he had Down syndrome, they really, were shocked. And she was shocked by the fact that they would sort of question his right to life while he's standing right there.
Exactly.
And she sort of goes on to, after she tells her story, to talk about, she says, and I'm going to quote, "The availability of abortion seems to be eroding societal consensus about our collective responsibility for vulnerable people, those with disabilities that were or could have been diagnosed prenatally, or even people born into difficult family situations or social structures." It's a really quite compelling argument in which she just talks about, this type of genetic abortion really moving us into eugenic type of frame of mind, where we look at the cost and benefit of different lives. Which lives are worth living, sort of in economic terms? And it's very, very sad.
And there's that word again, eugenics. I mean, it's one that a lot of people never hear, but we really have to become aware of it, because it's having an extraordinarily horrific effect on our society.
Yeah, and what I was amazed to find out is that somewhere between, they don't know exactly, but somewhere above 80% of women who learn that they have babies with genetic abnormalities abort. And so, it becomes sort of this real special feature when you're born with Down syndrome, because so many of those Down babies or other types of babies with chromosomal defects or whatever it may be are aborted. And yet, from what I gather, those babies bring so much joy to the families who have them. They really change those families, change the parents for the better, but also they're just very joyful people.
Yes, they
are. And I think that itself, really gives us a taste of what we're doing, that we're saying, these babies won't have, whatever characteristics I want them to have, and so I'm gonna rid myself of the possibility of the joy that this baby could give me in my own self-transformation through needing to deny myself more, whatever it is, in order to care for this baby, to become more compassionate, whatever it is, or just in the joy of that baby brings to the world.
They're truly God's lambs. This is a fascinating discussion. We have to take a one-minute break. Can you stay with us just through 1 minute?
Sure.
Okay, great, Erica. Thanks. Erica.
Hello, Erica.
I have to tell you, can I just interrupt and tell you, I wish that we had a station like this here in Boston. Everything's been great. I've been uplifted by scripture. I've been informed what's going on in the South here, and wow, it's been great. Thanks.
We just appreciate you taking time out for us.
Sure.
You can listen to us at KVSS.com. We stream.
Oh, great.
Okay.
Yeah, we stream. So, Erica, we'd love to have you listen. And the Archdiocese of Omaha is a very active pro-life community, and this issue we struggle with every day. One of the things that in society right now, when you hear people like, for example, John Kerry, who says this is all about faith, and somehow he can separate his, you know, because it's about faith, I can separate my opinion. But you can't really do that, can you? Because it's about science.
Yeah, that's right. And that's something that's really critical. I mean, sometimes I don't want anyone to mention that I have this master's in theology because, you know, they'll think, oh, it's just this religious issue, when in fact, it's just really not at all. Yeah. And you can, I mean, I think that that's what's really good. One of the really good things about the Costa Choice is that there's really very little about God. Not that we should dismiss God from the argument. Of course, he's, you know, right there. But that it really is philosophical arguments, historical arguments, medical arguments. I mean, first of all, in terms of embryology, you know, most people now realize, you know, percentage-wise in America that human life is taken. Human life is taken. We know that scientifically in an abortion, all abortion, because, you know, all of the medical community has said that life starts at conception. I mean, some want to try to talk about implantation, but either way, a woman doesn't even know she's pregnant by the time of implantation. So when an abortion happens, human life is absolutely taken. The American public is coming around to seeing that, and so even some of them, pretty good majorities, say that, you know, abortion is actually murder, and yet I think because of this sticking point, you know, where they think that, oh, well, even if I think it's wrong, women should have the right to choose type thing. I mean, they kind of, it's almost like they take their brain out of their head at that point and just say, oh, it doesn't matter what science says, what embryology says, anything like that. Women should just have the right to choose. And when you push them on it, they really have nothing else to say other than women should have the right to choose. I mean, I was one of them. I know that there's not that many arguments except this sort of mistaken notion that abortion is important for women's equality, is necessary, is a sort of a necessary precondition to women's equality. And that's why this book and these line of arguments, though, of course, the sanctity of life argument is primary, of course, this line of arguments of how abortion has hurt culture, has hurt women, you know, just in terms of equality, you know, thinking that women have to become like men, but then also in terms of women's health, these arguments are so critical because we can talk in, you know, a very reasonable way, very calm, rational way about all of the ways in which abortion has harmed women, harmed culture, and of course takes the life of the baby. And so this is where I think we got to go. I mean, from the perspective of someone who's been on the other side, these are the arguments that I think just put the other side, really silence the other side.
Yeah, and it really has in the 30 years since Roe v. Wade, it has kind of become one of those cornerstone elements to this whole moral relativism that's out there.
Yeah, that's right. Absolutely. I mean, people just, again, take their heads out of their brains or brains out of their heads or whatever, and they just, you know, they kind of say, well, it's okay for you, I guess, even though they think it's aberrant, morally aberrant themselves. And, you know, so that's why I think that hopefully we're going to see greater numbers of people wanting to do away with this. And let me just point out, if I have a minute,
sure.
Yep.
Because there's a real misconception out there about what John Roberts would do to the federal, you know, the Supreme Court, and also what would happen if Roe were overturned. So the first thing is, who knows what John, I mean, I think he sounds like a great judge. And what I want to say is first, that if he were to get on the court, there's a great chance if he is, you know, does interpret the, you know, Constitution strictly, that you'd see partial abortion laws upheld, which would be a wonderful victory. The second thing is that he is not what is necessary for Roe to be overturned. You still need two more judges. And what happens if Roe were overturned? I mean, the fight's not over. I'm sure you guys know this, but a lot of people don't realize, mainly because the media out there does this great disservice by misinforming them that that Roe really just, you know, if it's overturned, it sends the issue back to the states.
Right.
The other, you know, and so you have to battle that out there. Here in Massachusetts, we'd probably have abortion laws just as, you know, unlimited as they are now were Roe overturned. The other misconception is that when media goes out or these polling outlets go out and ask the American public what they think of Roe, they define Roe as only allowing abortion in the first trimester, which is actually totally untrue. Because of a companion case decided the same day, Doe versus Bolton, and if you want to understand more about this, go, you know, read the book, especially Marion Glennon's first essay. You know, because of this companion case, there was this big loophole in this whole idea of a first trimester because there's a health exception, which has been basically defined as well-being, which has been defined as a hangnail, a headache. In fact, anything the woman wants. So that's why pro-life people are very right legally when they say there's abortion on demand. That's why you have things like partial birth abortion. Roe does not just allow first trimester abortions. So when the polling agencies go out there and they say, what do you think of Roe? Roe allows first trimester abortions. What do you think of it? Well, then you see only a third or so supporting overturning Roe. Right?
Mm-hmm.
But then
right.
we ask the question, what do you think of abortion? What do you think of abortions in the second trimester? What do you think of abortions for this or that reason? You'll see that a good majority of people want strict limitations on abortion. They just want to see abortion in the cases of rape, incest, or to secure the life of the mother, despite all this, you know, thought that there's support for Roe. So
right.
really, I mean, the media, again, is pulling the wool over people's eyes. And that's really important when you're out there having discussions about Roe to say, do you know what Roe really does? And if they don't believe you, you know, give them the book and show them very reasonable arguments that show what the actual text says, that it is, you know, health of the mother, or excuse me, any type of health issue, not life of the mother, not even big serious health issues, just whatever, whatever. Even
right.
if it's, you know, they don't like the sex of the baby. I don't know how that's considered health of the mother. I guess emotional health or something like that. But it's really an unlimited license, and it's far more unlimited than any other Western democracy, if you can believe it.
You make a really important point, Erica. The thing is, when we try to have discussions with people on this, when we talk about the morality of it from a faith base, if they're not operating out of that system, they'll discount you immediately.
That's right. So don't even go there.
Right. So what you have to have, it's almost an apologetic type of approach to it. You have to have all the other information that they were, the scientific information.
That's
you
right.
have to have all those things. And that's what your essays and that's what your work and what you're trying to do to get out there.
That's right. That's right. And if they want to talk about religious elements, you know, get them at the end. Talk about that later. But really, in a culture where we live in now, where people are, they think, oh, separation of church and state, separation of church and me. I mean, they just never want to talk about it. They think that there's no validity to any of those arguments. Well, fine. Then don't go there at all. Go to the arguments that they're willing to talk about. And you'll find, frankly, that a lot of people don't even want to have rational discussions. Forget
right.
about it. I mean, even discussions of God, but they have a hard time making rational arguments. So, you know, confront them in a very gentle way with all of these things and then let them be, you know?
That's right.
And hopefully their consciences, which will get them in the end, and they'll begin to see, you know, the truth of the matter.
Well, Erica, we want to thank you so much for sharing your time and talents and everything with us this morning.
You're a good soldier. You're out there on the front lines. We appreciate it so
Thank
much.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you for your work.
You're speaking right. for them. You're one of those people that have stepped up and have taken the risk, and you're speaking for the unborn and for women. Thank you.
Thank you.
All right. God bless, Erica.
God bless you.
All right. Take care. Bye-bye.
Bye.